Welcome back to Gideon Hawthorne in the In-Between. I'm your host, Mackenzie Gentz, and you're listening to my podcast about the relevancy of literature in the 21st century. Now blow out that candle and let's begin. If you hadn't yet deduced by the spooky sounds and irregular upload date, let me be the first to tell you that this is an October bonus episode and part of a mini-series that I'm calling Horrifying Classics. Our book today is The Turn of the Screw by Henry James. First up is our harrowing one-minute summary. This is yet another example of a Romantic Era frame narrative, which is just a story within a story. Other examples include Heart of Darkness, Wuthering Heights, and Frankenstein. In our outer frame, an unnamed narrator is visiting a Christmas Eve party, and the gentleman and a few squeamish ladies in the room are trading ghost stories. A man named Douglas chimes in and begins to tell them of a tale involving a governess that was convinced by a handsome, well-to-do man to take care of his niece and nephew after their parents and, hint hint, most recent governess had died. We never return to the outer frame because at this point Douglas starts to read a written account by the governess herself, and the perspective shifts accordingly. So the governess arrives at the man's country estate called Bly to meet Flora, the little niece, and Mrs. Gross, the housekeeper. She's also soon met with the news that the nephew, Miles, a reportedly knavish child, is being sent home from school by the headmaster on grounds of expulsion. It isn't long before she begins to see a man on the premises, first on one of the house's towers and then peering into a window. Properly spooked, she consults Mrs. Gross, who identifies the man as Peter Quint, a former valet that died at Bly. She also begins to see the ghost of Miss Jessel, who is said to be the old governess and her predecessor. The current governess is convinced that the ghosts are after the children, and that though the children give no indication of having seen any ghosts, they are seeing them nonetheless. Things settle a little, and the children grow fond of their new caregiver. Meanwhile, the paranormal experiences only increase. The governess sees Peter Quint glaring from the landing of the stairs, and Miss Jessel crying from the bottom of them during the subsequent nights. That and the children are known to get up in the middle of the night and mysteriously peer from windows or go out into the expanse of lawn, alone. She concludes that these instances must be related to their frequent communications with the ghosts. Mrs. Gross advocates for the governess to send a letter to an employer, who only relents after restless Miles asks to go back to school, and she has her worst encounter yet with Miss Jessel in the schoolroom. The governess consults with Miles in his bedroom at night, where they have an eerie and vague conversation. To top it off, the candle goes out, and he lets out a blood-curdling scream. The next day, Flora goes missing. Luckily, she's found by the lake, but when the governess points out that Miss Jessel is also in attendance, neither Mrs. Gross nor Flora confirm her presence. This is where the governess loses it. Flora then becomes very ill, and Mrs. Gross takes her away to her uncle and leaves the governess with Miles. Oh, and one more thing. That SOS letter she wrote to her boss? It's missing. Alone with Miles, she questions him until he confesses that he took the letter and then sees Peter Quint outside the window for the last time. She asks Miles to identify the ghost, and in a flurry of energy, he drops dead in her arms. Symbols. Candles. So candles literally give way to darkness when they're blown out, but they also represent comfort, safety, and protection in the novel. The governess falls asleep to the comfort of the candle, and every time the children get up to their misdeeds, the candle is mysteriously blown out. So Bly itself, the country estate, it's kind of like the mind. It's this huge, elaborate, imaginative place that the children and the governess explore on a daily basis. But even though it has every dreamed amenity possible, it's also uncharted and, like the mind, can give way to some rather unexpected experiences. The places at Bly that she sees ghosts at are places that she's uncomfortable with, such as the lake and outside the house and in the tower. So these are all places that in her mind are kind of dark already at Bly. I wanted to look at names. Mrs. Gross, that's a very deliberate placement of a name on a character. And this character is the one that ultimately leads the governess to have her insane meltdown at the end of the novel. Overall, she's unreasonably reasonable. Flora is another name that's really indicative of the character. Flora is this light, like, beautiful flower of a child, and she has a very precocious, capricious image. There are also unnamed characters in the novel, so these are characters like the governess, the uncle, and the narrator at the beginning of the novel. These characters, give an air of mystery, and makes it deliberately vague enough to convey this kind of a psychological thriller. If everything was super concrete, everyone had names, every person had very specific characteristics, then it would be harder to grasp the duality of this kind of narrative. Lenses. So obviously, again, just like last week, the most prominent lens is a psychological lens, but I'm not going to go with the most obvious route again. I'm going to look at this book through a gender lens. So in The Outer Frame, the women are portrayed as fleeting and immediate creatures. They make constant comments like, "Oh, how delicious," and don't care about much other than the love story between the governess and some of the other men mentioned. There are constant comments about the woman being too scared to hear the stories. Curiously enough, the rest of the story is actually told from a woman's perspective, and the governess seems rather autonomous. Considering this, I didn't really notice anything that digressed from that reading of her in the novel. It's true that I'm not the most perceptive reader in terms of the gender lens, but I also feel like I would have noticed something even if it wasn't super obvious. Mrs. Gross, almost like Myrtle Wilson from The Great Gatsby, is an extremely robust, lively, strong for most intents and purposes woman character. I know that neither her nor the governess has a proper job in this novel, but I don't think that those things were on the radar yet for society. So it makes sense that James would portray these strong women in those roles. Also, there's the fact that no one really knows whether this is an actual ghost story or whether the governess is just crazy, but that wouldn't be different just because she's a woman. You know, he could be writing this about a man, and the story would conceivably be the same. I guess the question ultimately is, did James adhere to the portrayal of women given in The Outer Frame or in The Inner Frame in his personal life? So for this, I had to do a lot more research, and I actually found overwhelmingly that James was super ahead of his time. The book was published in 1898, and it turns out, no pun intended, that the majority of his audience was made up of women, so catering to them was one of his objectives. Quotes. Just like last week, the episode is too short for me to go over tons of passages, so I just chose one that really stuck in my memory from the times that I've read this. This is when Miss Jessel appears in the schoolroom when the kids and Mrs. Gross are at church. She rose, not as if she had heard me, but with an indescribable grand melancholy of indifference and detachment, and within a dozen feet of me stood there as my vile predecessor. Dishonored and tragic, she was all before me, but even as I fixed and, from memory, secured it, the awful image passed away. Dark as midnight in her black dress, her haggard beauty and her unutterable woe, she had looked at me long enough to appear to say that her right to sit at my table was as good as mine to sit at hers. While these instants lasted, indeed I had the extraordinary chill of a feeling that it was I who was the intruder. It was as a wild protest against it that, actually addressing her, "You miserable, terrible woman," I heard myself break into a sound that, by the open door, rang through the long passage and the empty house. She looked at me as if she heard me, but I had recovered myself and cleared the air. There was nothing in the room the next minute but the sunshine and the sense that I must stay. Word covers can be taken in two ways. First, book covers. Second, a new version of something initially written or performed by someone else. Today we are going to look at actual book covers, and yes, I know that this is an audio-based format. Please get over the irony and follow me for a minute here. I've handpicked 7 of the best and worst covers to describe and critique for you all today. Most of these were found on Bazaar Victoria, and as always, there's a link in the description for that. Finally, I'm going to be rating these out of 9 turns of the screw so I can give some indication of how good or bad I think they are. First is the edition that I have been reading from. Again, I really love the footnotes in the Barnes & Noble Classics editions, which is why I generally grab for those. So it looks exactly like the cover for The Scarlet Letter and has what looks like a handmaid from The Handmaid's Tale going through some catacombs. I actually picked up The Scarlet Letter instead of The Turn of the Screw when I was prepping for this episode, so it gets a really low rating for me on selectability. I'm gonna give it a 4 out of 9 turns. So the second cover has a robin's egg blue background with the governess and children standing in front of a window. The governess is wearing a water lily dress and the window behind her has several pairs of eyes peering inside. The R's in Turn of the Screw are backwards. This cover is laden with hidden symbolisms, which you know that I love, like things being turned around, literally, the perspective being unreliable, or things being innately sexual, the water lilies. So I'm giving this a 10 out of 9 turns. This is the best cover I've ever seen of Turn of the Screw. Next, Vintage Classics. So this has a porcelain doll on the cover. It kind of has the Annabelle doll vibe, but it's laying down, so thankfully there's no direct eye contact. There are no indications of ghosts or anything on the cover. The doll is definitely inanimate. With that, I'm going to leave this with a 2 out of 9 turns, and I'm only rating it so high because I like the Vintage Classics versions of Murakami books. Next is the cover of the movie The Turn of the Screw. The main character that plays the governess is on the cover holding a candle, and yes, I know that's a classic trope, but I'm surprisingly okay with this because this is the first psychological horror book, so it kind of has the right to cover the popular cover tropes, and the cover itself is kind of a chiaroscuro, so that's why I'm going to leave it with 5 out of 9 turns. The next edition is from WDL Books. This is totally Scooby-Doo. It has a blonde Daphne holding a candle on the stairway. The scene includes a Peter Quint who looks exactly like a blue Elvis. It has bright pink title letters in a font presumably called Mystery Machine and says a story of horror which has baffled every reader. I think that's one of the funniest blurbs I've ever heard. Just because it doesn't cite an author and it's really, really vague. I give this an 8 out of 9 turns because it's so bad it might just be good. The next cover I'm calling Orange because it too doesn't have a publisher on the front. This cover is almost entirely orange with the exception of the governess's blue dress, but we'll get to that in a second. The font looks like it's from a bad movie called A Night in Arabia or something. There's some additional white text in the upper left-hand corner, but it's rendered unreadable. This one features another staircase, but this time it's what looks like Kate Bush from the Wuthering Heights music video running from a badly rendered vampire. It looks like the vampire is either on fire or has a fur coat, but on further inspection, it turns out that Vampy just has a blurry arm because he's supposed to be a ghost. Well, I couldn't help but give this 6 out of 9 turns just because of the Kate Bush likeness. Finally, we have the great classic series, the tour de force of all of the covers that I've ever seen of Turn of the Screw. And oh boy, are there many. This one has a blue background and two red-orange wrenches fighting over a single screw. It looks like two crab hands on first glance, but alas, we are not that lucky today. One of the wrenches is super rusty and the other is shining. And that's it. This is the worst book cover I've ever seen, period. It looks like it could be on a science textbook or on a wrench cleaner. So I am leaving this unrated. I can't even give it the satisfaction of having 0 turns. If you enjoyed the episode and would like to hear more from me, consider checking out the last episode where I muse over The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe. Everything DH and I can be found at didianandhawthorne.blueberry.net, except blueberry is spelled B-L-U-B-R-R-Y. Also, stay tuned for the next episode in 4 days' time on Tuesday. It will finally be the discussion on the immortal life of Henrietta Lacks that we've all been waiting for. Our next horrifying classic will be Something Wicked This Way Comes by Ray Bradbury. Still there? One more thing then. Remember that leaving a comment or review on iTunes, Spotify, or any other Guilty Pleasure podcast platform helps leverage the show so that other literature enthusiasts can find the community. In other words, it helps a ton. See you guys on Tuesday.